The final years of the 8th century were dominated by the threat and then the military invasion from Assyria. By the end of the 8th century, the beginning of the 7th, all you've got is Judah, and all you've got in Judah basically is Jerusalem. So everything's shattered. And you can't read the words, it's too far away, I imagine. But if you look at what was the Northern Kingdom, it's divided into different Assyrian provinces. So we begin now with the 7th century. The 7th century in Judah began with the devastation of Judah by the Assyrian army under Sennacherib. That's in 701. And ended with the siege and capture of Jerusalem by the Babylonian army under Nebuchadnezzar in 598. For this most of the century, Assyria will still be the dominant power. But towards the end, Babylon conquers Assyria, and then Babylon becomes the new superior nation from the southern part of what we'll now call Iraq, comes in and captures Jerusalem. So that's the story. Hezekiah's son, Manasseh, came to the throne as a boy of 12 in 698. He reigned till 643, a long reign. He had no choice but to submit to being a vassal of the Assyrian king. There would have been those in Judah, probably including priests from the smaller sanctuaries, who blamed Hezekiah for the way things turned out. And many welcomed Manasseh's long reign. Subject to Assyria, yes, but basically peaceful. Things fell apart religiously in the first half of the 7th century. But because he was a loyal vassal of the powerful Assyrian king, there was peace and growing economic prosperity. So Judah is being restored. During Manasseh's reign, Egypt was conquered by Assyria. A puppet regime was created. It's called the 26th dynasty, and Sais is a town in the Delta of the Nile, which was their capital. So the Said dynasty, it's called. However, by the middle of the 7th century, Assyria's dominance in the region was beginning to wane. When Babylon revolted in 652, it took the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal 4 years to assert his authority over Babylon. In 640, so we're now in the second half of the 7th century, Manasseh's son Amon was assassinated. Amon's 8-year-old son, Josiah, inherited the throne. And I've talked about Josiah a lot with you, and I'll be going over it again now, but in the historical setting. Josiah seized the opportunity of Assyria being caught up in struggling against Babylon, so it withdrew its military and its influence and its garrisons. He was determined to win back for Judah the northern kingdom and the land that tradition said was promised Israel by Yahweh. So Josiah brooked no opposition in his determination to reform the religious life of the people. This was the opportunity that the Deuteronomic school had been waiting for. At last, they had a champion ready to carry out with rigorous efficiency the reform for which they had been preparing. In 622, on Josiah's orders, the temple was being cleared of Assyrian altars with a view to being reconsecrated. When a document called the Book of the Law in the literature of the Deuteronomists, Book of Kings, it was, inverted commas, discovered in the temple. Scholars have no idea whether it was actually discovered or whether that's a nice word for planted there and picked up and said to be discovered. We're told that when Josiah heard the words of the book of the law, he was disturbed because they obviously weren't following it, and he made a covenant before Yahweh to follow Yahweh, keeping his commandments, his decrees and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, all his mind, all his strength. That's what Deuteronomy talks about, of course, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in the book. And all the people who were looking for a Messiah, a new anointed king, were happy to come in behind him and do what you need to do to get an army organized, etc. Josiah insisted that all cult, all religious worship, had to take place in the Jerusalem temple. His great-grandfather Hezekiah had tried to do that, but it didn't have time to insist on it. Josiah does. This centralizing of the cult was the single most influential change brought about by Josiah's reforms. It's backed up again and again in Deuteronomy. And as they say it, God, Moses is saying, in a place that I will determine, God will determine. It doesn't actually name Jerusalem, because that would be anachronistic, but in the literature itself, the place that God chosen clearly means Jerusalem. This accounts for many changes that dramatically affected the way worship was carried out in Judah. Things would never be the same again. Josiah cleared Judah of all cult sites, expanded the borders in every direction. This was possible because Egypt was still not strong and Assyria was fighting a losing battle with Babylon and with the Medes. In 614, Ashur, from which the word Assyria comes, the religious capital, was sacked by the Medes. 2 years later, Nineveh was sacked. Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Finkelstein and Silberman write in their book, basically, the kingdom of Judah was a direct continuation of Judah under Manasseh's reign. In spite of the bad press that Manasseh gets, and Josiah gets a very favourable press. Its population, probably, archaeology is not a absolutely strict science. I mean, it is a science, but it's a bit wobbly. But they say it probably didn't exceed 75,000 people. Down below, to help you put that into perspective, or to help me rather, the latest population I could get for the population of Campbelltown was in 2012. It's more now, I know, but it was a population of 150,000. Half that was the population of Judah at the time of Josiah. Half Campbelltown then. Probably a third of what Campbelltown is now. Dotted, mostly desert and hills that you can't do anything with. Jerusalem, Hebron, Beersheba down the south. Oh, I haven't got the map there, you've seen it a few times. It had a relatively dense occupation of the rural areas in the Judean hill country, a network of settlements in the arid zones of the east and south, and a relatively sparse population in the Shephelah, that is the lowlands, sweeping down towards, but not including, the Mediterranean coast. It was in many ways a densely settled city-state, as the capital held about, I don't know what that should read, a certain percent of the population. Urban life in Jerusalem reached a peak that would be equaled only in Roman times. The state was well organized, highly centralized, as in the time of Manasseh, But in terms of its religious development, say the scholars, and literary expression of national identity, the era of Josiah marked a dramatic new stage in Judah's history. So, smallish population growing in importance and ready for expansion and for the literature that will guide it in that and encourage it in that. In 609, the Assyrian army suffered a crushing defeat at Haran in north. Necho II, Pharaoh of Egypt, was heading north to assist Assyria, the Battle of Carchemish. It appears that he summoned Josiah to Megiddo to receive from him an oath of allegiance, loyalty, but he had him executed. And that dashed the dream of Judah. Let's look at the prophets that speak in these last years of the 7th century. There's nothing, whatever they said at the time of Manasseh, we haven't got any record of it. The record, the prophecies that we have are in critical stages, like the collapse of Samaria. That's where those four come from. Now we're going to have people at the collapse of Jerusalem. The first one is Zephaniah, writing about 628 to 620. We're told in the by the authors that organise these texts in verse 1 that Zephaniah ministry took place in the days of King Josiah. So that's the second part of the 7th century. Zephaniah was influenced by Amos, a prophet whose ministry took place in the northern kingdom some 130 years earlier. But the stuff's come down with the refugees, so that's available. He no doubt read it or was inspired by it. Amos spoke of the day of Yahweh as being a day when Yahweh would act not to save his people, as they assume, but to punish them for their infidelity. Zephaniah urges his contemporaries to turn to Yahweh before they're forced to face what he sees as God's punishment. He declares that the day of Yahweh is imminent. Though he speaks out against the people's sin and is firm in insisting on the need for repentance, that is not his main focus. True prophet that he is, his primary focus is on Yahweh, whose fidelity transcends our human sin. Yes, God will have to punish our human sin as he understands it. We would probably see sin's effects as flowing from the sin. He goes outside that and has God organising it. His primary focus is on Yahweh, whose fidelity is beyond and transcends our human sin. Amos's scroll ends on this note as well. If the people were ever to enjoy the presence of Yahweh in their midst, and the blessing consequent upon such a communion, they'd have to change their ways, says Zephaniah, and they'd have to change them drastically. Like other prophets, he explained God's punishment as an instrument of bringing about the purifying of the nation, and he bemoans the people's failure to repent. As a true prophet, his focus is on Yahweh, and he speaks of a remnant, a small group that will be faithful and will pick up the message and be real Yahwist followers. He speaks of restoration. He concludes with a remarkable statement of the passionate exuberance of God's longing for intimate communion with his people and the sheer delight God will have when this intimacy is restored. Final words, you're familiar with them, on the beautiful prophecy of Zephaniah. Then that song, and the Father will dance. On that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands grow weak. The Lord your God is in your midst. I, the warrior who gives victory. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will renew you in his love. He will exult over you with loud singing as on a day of festival. I will remove disaster from you so that you will not bear reproach for it. I'll deal with all your oppressors at that time, and I will save the lame and gather the outcast, and I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time, I will gather you, I will bring you home, for I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says Yahweh. Now, if you read the whole prophecy, you'd find a lot of stuff in it, but that's the conclusion. That's the focus that Zephaniah wants the people to have. The prophet Nahum. It was during Josiah's reign that Ashur, the religious capital of the Assyrian Empire, was sacked by the Medes with the backing of Babylon. Nahum looks forward with delight to the imminent fall of Nineveh. It's a very short prophecy, and if Ashur was gone, it looks like Nineveh is going to be the next to go, and Nahum is delighted about that because it's the evil empire, Assyria's capital. So he looks forward to the imminent fall of Nineveh, which happened at the time. His oracles best fit sometime in the period between 620 and 612, a decade or so after Zephaniah. He sees the collapse of Assyria as a sign of Yahweh's blessing to Judah. His exultation at Assyria's imminent collapse is also delight at Yahweh's faithfulness to his chosen people. Josiah's reforms were already bearing fruit, or so it must have seemed to this poet, this inspired poet, Nahum. Zephaniah had urged his countrymen to change their ways. He'd also promised the blessing of Yahweh on the remnant who heeded Yahweh's call. Nahum takes all this for granted. His focus concentrates on the fulfillment of Zephaniah's promise. Assyria is on its knees. Nineveh, the capital of the mightiest empire, couldn't hold out much longer. And Nahum gives expression to the pent-up feelings of subject Judah against its powerful oppressor. It doesn't make very nice reading. There's no love of your enemies in here, but you can well understand it. Here's his powerful poetry. The sudden shift from image to image sustains the excitement of the reader still today. Imagine its effect on Jerusalem at the time. At last, Assyria is brought to its knees, brackets, by God. Because God's behind all this, as they understood it. So that's the God in whom they believe. It promises wonderful things to come. Any people who've experienced the collapse of an oppressive enemy will understand Nahum's joy. Though our understanding of the place of God in warfare differs from Nahum's, he can still encourage us to believe in the ultimate triumph of good over evil. Though oppressive abuse of power can appear to dominate our world, evil cannot avoid the consequences that come in its train. We cannot follow Nahum in seeing mass destruction, which he does, as appropriate response to evil. We do well to balance the reading of Nahum by contemplating the final words of the book of Jonah, which read, God saying about Nineveh, should I not be concerned about Nineveh, that great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also many animals? Curtain falls, end of the prophecy of Jonah. Nahum and Jonah, had they been Nahum and the author of Jonah, if they were contemporaries, would have been on very different sides of the debate. They're both in the Bible. So we come to the final years of the kingdom of Judah. When King Josiah died in 609, the kingmakers of Judah bypassed Josiah's eldest son, Eliakim, and chose as king his younger brother, Shallum, who took the throne name Jehoahaz. They hoped he would continue the policies of his father, Josiah. However, the Egyptian emperor had a better idea. He deposed him, and he had the power to do so, in favour of Eliakim, who was given the throne name Jehoiakim, and of course was under the control of Egypt. This began the unravelling of the independence that Josiah had achieved. In 605, the Babylonian army led by Nebuchadnezzar defeated the combined forces of Assyria and Egypt in the Battle of Carchemish. You can see on your map, it's north of Jerusalem, of course. In 598, Nebuchadnezzar attacked Judah and besieged Jerusalem. Jehoiakim the king, appointed by Egypt, the enemy, Egypt and Assyria, are fighting for control of this area. He died during the siege, and he was succeeded briefly by his 18-year-old son, Jeconiah, sometimes called Comiah, who took the throne name Jehoiakim. He reigned for the first 3 months of 597 BC. He decided to surrender wisely, and the siege was lifted. Jerusalem was not destroyed. He was taken into exile along with all the leading citizens. Nebuchadnezzar replaced Jehoiakim with his uncle Mattaniah, who was given the throne name Zedekiah. Zedek is justice. Yahweh is justice. So that's the situation. Zedekiah was tempted to seek alliance with Egypt and revolt against Babylon. And when he finally did so, Nebuchadnezzar decided to lay siege to Jerusalem. This time he's going to destroy it forever. This time he was determined to raze the city to the ground. And he succeeded in doing that in 586. Another group of leading citizens was taken into exile, and the king's men, boys, were all murdered before his eyes. His eyes were gouged out, and he was carted off in chains, and we don't know what happened to him, to Babylon. This is the period of the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk speaks out against the lack of justice in the institutions of Judah during Jehoiakim's reign. All this makes complete logic if you keep in mind the unquestioned assumption that is all the way through the Old Testament, that God controls what happens in the world. The all-powerful God is pulling all the strings. So if something terrible is happening, they immediately conclude God must be punishing them. And if God is just, God is punishing them for something they've done wrong. That's a simple logic. You can no longer hold it once you see Jesus crucified. Well, you shouldn't hold it, though some theology tried to grab it and bring it in. If someone as beautiful and innocent as Jesus can be crucified, clearly God isn't doing it. So it shatters this unthought out position. God is all powerful, yes, but not all powerful control, all powerful love. Very different. Habakkuk sees the attacks on Judah precipitated by the Chaldeans, people from Mesopotamia, as being Yahweh's response to Judah's failure to live the Torah. The material from Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12 to 2:20 appears to come from the time of Zedekiah, between the capture of Jerusalem in 698 and its sacking in 587. As it's written against the background of actual experience of Babylonian oppression. The psalm, and there is a psalm in the so-called prophecy of Habakkuk, in chapter 3 forms an excellent conclusion to Habakkuk's oracles. Habakkuk struggles with the violence of the aggressive policies of the new superpower, Babylon. He struggles to believe that justice will prevail, so that, quote, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the water covers the sea. He gives voice to the oppressed as their cry pierces the heavens. God doesn't seem to be listening. God doesn't seem to be doing anything. He's already seen the submission of Jerusalem and the exile of everybody, and things are looking grim in Jerusalem. Habakkuk forces us to look at the systems under which we live in whatever nation we belong to. He then expands our reflection to the international stage, to look at the way stronger states dominate weaker ones and are able to manipulate systems to their own benefit while oppressing others. It's all very relevant to our world. His ridicule of the pretensions of imperial power in chapter 2 is also a warning to us personally not to put our trust in wealth, in security that isn't based on faith. Putting our trust in power, honour, reputation. We must be careful not to worship what we can control. This goes even for the danger of limiting God to our inherited and contrived ways of understanding the deity. In his concluding prayer, Habakkuk chapter 3, he affirms his belief in God's power, and in spite of the calamity that appears inevitable, he concludes with one of the finest expressions of faith to be found in the Old Testament. His key contribution is his insistence that the righteous will live because of faith. And it's very difficult to be sure. Maybe it's got both ideas. It's talking about faith means the faithfulness of God to us. That's primary. And he also seems to encompass our faith in God. So it's a mutual faithfulness that is the way forward. In the New Testament, Paul picks this up in his wonderful letter to the Romans. In gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, says Paul, as it is written, and here he is, picking Habakkuk, the one who is righteous will live by faith. Now, Paul means God's faithfulness to us. And he adds something that Habakkuk could never have imagined, the gift to us of Jesus' faith in God. So it's not just now God's faith in us and our response of faith in God. There's a mediator coming in here. And we have God's faith in us shown in Jesus. And Jesus becomes the one whose faith is gifted to us to respond to God. So we're not the ones believing. Jesus is believing in us if we make space and empty ourselves for him. I live no longer I, says Paul. It's Christ who lives in me. Again, if I had the Jerusalem Bible with me, I should be reading from it because it's much better than this. But these are the last words of Habakkuk, reading from the New Revised Standard Version. It's a good translation. It just isn't rhetoric. It doesn't land and engage the will. But I'll give it to you now. Though the fig tree does not blossom, there's no fig trees blossoming at this time, the destruction of the city. Though the fig tree doesn't blossom and there's no fruit on the vine. Though the produce of the olive fails and the fields yield no food. Though the flock is cut off from the fold and there's no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will exult in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He takes me to the heights. It's lovely poetry, isn't it? And they're the final words of this prophet. And now we come to the last part of this, and we're going to focus on a prophet that everybody loves because he's so human and his feelings are rich, and he lived at such a terrible time. He lived through the destruction of the city. But to be honest, when you read the prophecy of Jeremiah right through, most of it is about punishment, God's anger. There's a heck of a lot of stuff in there you might want to read twice. He's writing during the reign of Jehoiakim from 609 to 598. That's the last of the kings before his son briefly took over. And Zedekiah, the uncle of the young king that was taken into exile. So he's writing in this terrible period, 609 to 587. Jeremiah's was a lone voice. His contemporaries dismissed him at his oracles as the ravings of a religious crank. Moreover, there was no lack of self-acclaimed prophets who kept reassuring the people that it was impossible for Jerusalem to fall. The temple of Yahweh is here, for God's sake. And look what happened in 701. Everything else fell, but not Jerusalem. God will never allow it, say all these, inverted commas, prophets of peace. They guaranteed their security by Yahweh. Jeremiah kept insisting that their security depended on their response, their fidelity. And no one wanted to listen to him. In 598, the Babylonian army captured Jerusalem and the leaders were taken in exile. Jeremiah was not considered of any significance. He's left behind. Another priest was taken over, Ezekiel. We'll hear about him later. Not today, but later. Zedekiah, the one put in after the capture of Jerusalem and before its destruction, he kept vacillating between submission to Babylon and courting favour with Egypt. And Jeremiah is very clear, forget about Egypt, it's stupid, and he was right. You've got to submit to Babylon, otherwise you'll end up being wiped out. In 588, the Babylonian army again laid siege to the city, and this time they showed no mercy. More people were taken into exile. It was the end of an era. Judah, the last of the tribes of Israel, was utterly devastated. It was Jeremiah's lot to minister as a prophet during the terrible final years of Judah's decline. This accounts for the unrelenting criticism of the policies that led to the disasters of 597 and then 586. and the dire warnings of divine punishment that all but fill the scroll of Jeremiah. To read the Jeremiah scroll, we need to put ourselves among the exiles in Babylon as they tried to grasp what they understood as Yahweh's will in using the Babylonians to humble Judah. Why would he have done that? The priests are asking. The Deuteronomists are asking. The disciples of Isaiah are asking. They're all trying to work this all out because God clearly willed it, they thought. So, what do we do to get God on side again? We need to picture in exile the elders, the priests, the scholars of various schools struggling to understand what had gone wrong. Jeremiah's oracles would have been an important source for their reflections, and their insights are incorporated into the scroll. Some of these insights are expressed in homiletic form, aimed at inspiring the other exiles to learn from Jeremiah. He proved right, so they kept his stuff. We don't know what on earth. All the other prophets just vanished because they were wrong anyhow. As one would expect, the homilies expressed what Yahweh had revealed to Jeremiah by drawing out the implications of Jeremiah's words, done in exile, in ways that connected with their experience. Jeremiah has a lot to say about divine punishment. This is to be expected, for he lived through the capture of Jerusalem and its destruction. He also has a lot to say about the so-called prophets who don't listen to God and don't proclaim God's word. You'd expect that, and you can read it for yourself later. Very critical of these self-acclaimed prophets. Jeremiah, this is the beauty, had a radical trust in Yahweh. Along with this trust went an honesty in expressing his personal suffering and the doubts he experienced, as well as the confusion he felt at God's giving him the ministry and then appearing to leave him high and dry. Especially when the situation made it appear that his words were not being fulfilled. He felt used by God. He felt deceived by God. In no other prophetic scroll do we find such feelings expressed so powerfully and convincingly as in Jeremiah, who's really, really honest about his doubts and his feelings and his problems and his faith. It would be tragic if the extensive focus on divine punishment were to obscure Jeremiah's conviction concerning the special love Yahweh has for his people. And I'm now going to give you a bit of an extended taste of Jeremiah. Chapter 12, verse 7. I have forsaken my house, says Yahweh. I've abandoned my heritage. I've given the beloved of my heart, God speaking, into the hands of her enemies. God, this is what happened, and God speaking with a broken heart at what he had to do. Chapter 13, verse 11, a very kind of an intimate image here. As the loincloth clings to one's loins, so I made the whole house of Israel and the whole house of Judah cling to me in the place of love-giving, life-giving. Cling to me in order that they might be for me a people, a name, a praise, and a glory. I held them in my lap, like so close, but they wouldn't listen. That's how Jeremiah saw it. That's how he has God saying, they just wouldn't listen. I've loved you, says God through Jeremiah in chapter 31. I've loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I've continued my faithfulness to you. Things look terrible, I know, but don't ever doubt that I'm being faithful. Please learn your lesson. Chapter 32. You show steadfast love to the thousandth generation. But you repay the guilt of parents into the laps of their children after them, a great and mighty God whose name is Yahweh. Jeremiah says, which we see too, if I sin, it's going to affect my kids for sure, and it's going to affect their kids. But after that, it kind of peters out. It affects you to the second generation. Good that I might do. Any good I do goes on for a thousand generations. Thousands, their biggest number. So it just means endless. So Jeremiah, Deuteronomy, they don't want us to equate sin with virtue. They don't want us to get so caught up in what we did wrong that it obliterates what we're doing right. If we've done wrong, then do right, because it'll have a thousand times more effect than any wrong you've done. Pretty good statement. Here's Jeremiah again. I thought how I would set you among my children and give you a pleasant land, the most beautiful heritage of all the nations. And I thought you'd call me my father and would not turn from following me. One of the very rare uses of father applied to God. Get the New Testament, it's all over the place because of Jesus' personal prayer up. But here it is. I wanted you to call me Abba, Father. And turn, you wouldn't turn away. My anguish, says Jeremiah, chapter 4, verse 19. I writhe in pain over the walls of my heart. My heart is beating wildly. I cannot keep silent, for I hear the sound of trumpet, the alarm of war. Jeremiah's living through the besieging and the starvation and the plague and what's going on in Jerusalem. And his whole body is trembling with the agony of it all. For the hurt of my poor people, I am hurt. I mourn. Dismay has taken hold of me. And that's how Jeremiah feels about it all, of course. But he also feels that he's feeling God's feelings. He's a prophet. So these are very intimate images of God coming through this wonderfully feeling man. Oh, that my head were a spring of water and my eyes a fountain of tears, so that I might weep day and night for the slain of my poor people. Once you see, I'm sure you're getting it, once you see this written during the besieging and years it took and the destruction of the city, they make more sense. You feel them and then you think, how can that apply to today? Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he the child I delight in? God speaking through the prophet. As often as I speak against him, critically, I still remember him. Therefore I'm deeply moved for him. Surely I will have mercy on him. The dad can't help himself. The mum can't help herself. The love will come through. The people are obstinate in their infidelity. Yahweh, however, is always faithful to the covenant. Again, Jeremiah, let those who boast in this, that they understand and know me, that I am Yahweh. Whenever you hear Yahweh, whenever you read the law, you must go back to the burning bush. It's not a name for God. It's a historical locating of who this God is. You must go back to the burning bush and you must hear God say to Moses, I've heard the cry of my people and I'm determined to release them. So this is the God of their big story, the Redeemer God, to God who led them, fed them, gave them water, nourished them. In spite of their stupidity and the rest of it, God remained faithful. Let those who boast, boast in this, for they understand and know me, that I'm Yahweh. I act with steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight. I, Yahweh, delight. Surely this is a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the people in exile. It's great to have it. And they must have kept a copy of it and found its way into the scroll. He's back in Jerusalem, destroyed Jerusalem, starving, the poor, devastated and all that. And he's writing to the people in exile because some of them are groaning and complaining and doing whatever you would do if you're in exile. And this is what he says to them from God. Surely, I know the plans I have for you, exiles. Plans for your welfare, not your harm, to give you a future full of hope. Then when you call upon me and come and pray to me, I'll hear you. Okay, yes, you made terrible mistakes. I had to punish you. I had to wake you up. But look, this is who I am. I'll hear you. And when you search for me, you'll find me if you seek me with all your heart. That's what you've got to do now. Not just fit me in. I'll let you find me. And I will restore your fortunes. I'll gather you from all the nations and all the places where I've driven you. And I'll bring you back to the place from which I sent you into exile. Imagine hearing that in exile. It kept the hope alive. Because it's Yahweh who is punishing, Jeremiah knows that the deserved punishment cannot be the final word. Yahweh will bring the exiles home and he will restore his land, his heritage, his vineyard. Jeremiah again, I will set my eyes upon them for good. I'll bring them back to this land. I'll build them up. I won't tear them down again. I'll plant them. I won't pluck them up. I'll give them a heart to know that I am Yahweh. And they will be my people, and I will be their God, for they will return to me with their whole heart. Again, Jeremiah, as for you, have no fear, my servant Jacob. Don't be dismayed, O Israel, for I'm going to save you from far away and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return and have quiet and ease, and no one will make them afraid, for I am with you to save you. You'll be my people, and I will be your God. As you read this, my mind just went back then. I think of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The absolute destruction of Judaism and the rabbis going to Yavne and trying to make sense of it all, because all this beautiful promise that's there again gets destroyed and they're trying to work out why. This literature just keeps them hoping, trusting, journeying. Again, Jeremiah, again I will build you. You shall be built, O virgin Israel. Virgin in the Bible is never a compliment. It's always, it's actually saying Israel who has not produced anything. So virgin reads negatively. It's not the fullness of womanhood in the way they're putting it. So when Israel is said to be virgin, it means they haven't produced life. I will build you, you shall be built, O virgin Israel. Again you shall take your tambourines and go forth in a dance of merrymaking. Again you shall plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria. The planters shall plant and shall enjoy the fruit. With weeping they will come, and with consolations I will lead them back. There's extraordinary literature written. And it did prove right that if it, within a generation they did come back. This is just a leap of faith of Jeremiah. I'll lead them back. I'll let them walk by brooks of water in a straight path in which they shall not stumble. For I become a father to Israel, and Ephraim is my firstborn, my favourite, the one who inherits. Jeremiah goes to the heart of Yahweh, when, in the tradition of the prophets who went before him, he challenges his contemporaries to live justly. In one of his more powerful statements, Jeremiah challenges the king, Jehoiakim, just before the destruction of Jerusalem, the fall of Jerusalem. He says, "Why don't you follow the example of your father?" And again, it's Josiah, the hero king. And this is what Jeremiah says to the reigning monarch. Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness, and his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbours work for nothing and doesn't give them their wages, who says, "I will build myself a spacious house with large upper rooms," and who cuts out windows for it, panelling it with cedar, painting it with vermilion. The king's obviously doing all this, palace. Are you a king because you compete in cedar? Did not your father, and to understand the text, we've got to know his father's Josiah. Did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? Then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and the needy. And then it was well. Is not this to know me? Well, that's a very powerful line. To know Yahweh is to care for the poor and needy. If we don't do that, whatever we call God is an idol. There it is. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well. Isn't this what it means to know me, says Yahweh? But your eyes and heart are only on your dishonest gain, shedding innocent blood and practicing oppression and violence. Hamas. Without justice, religious cult, says Jeremiah, is valueless. The priests did not say, "Where is Yahweh?" Those who handle the law did not know me, says God through Jeremiah. So no wonder he wasn't too popular. He's attacking all the people of power. Again, Jeremiah. Of what use to me is frankincense that comes from Sheba, or sweet cane from a distant land? Your burnt offerings are not acceptable, nor are your sacrifices pleasing to me. Yahweh asks for sincerity of heart. Jeremiah again. If you swear, "As Yahweh lives, in truth, in justice, and in uprightness," then nations shall be blessed by him, and by him they shall boast. But the house of Israel is uncircumcised. They're circumcised, all right, physically, but not their heart. Yahweh wants his people to obey his voice Jeremiah again, they do not know the way of Yahweh, the law of their God. They all alike had broken the yoke. They burst the bonds. And you might think Jesus talking about the yoke of the Pharisees weighing down on his contemporaries says, come over here, come to me, all you who are labour and a burden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke on you, because my yoke is about living to the full. It's about love. Forget all that stuff. Come here. Jeremiah again, thus says Yahweh, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths, where the good way lies, and walk in it, and find rest for your souls. The text I just gave you from the Gospel is that text. You'll find rest for your soul. Jeremiah wants them to go back to their ancient journey, not all this stuff. Go back to your traditions. Live them to the full. But they said, we will not walk in it. They've got a better idea. Yahweh wants his people to speak and do the truth. Jeremiah, you shall say to them, this is the nation that did not obey the voice of Yahweh their God, and did not accept discipline. Truth has perished. It is cut off from their lips. They bend their tongues like bows. They've grown strong in the land for falsehood, not for truth. They proceed from evil to evil, and they don't know me. Yahweh wants his people to know him, that is to say, to live in communion with him and enjoy the intimacy of love with which he, the fountain of living water, longs to bless them. And Jeremiah writes, let those who boast in this, that they understand and know me, me of course is God, that I am Yahweh. I act with steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight. Hear this, O foolish and senseless people, cries Jeremiah. People who have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they're not listening. Remember Jesus in Mark's Gospel says, do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? Well, he's echoing Jeremiah's words, which he learnt at his mother's knee. Don't you remember? Jeremiah, talking about the temple, has this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your sight? Quoted by Jesus in the collapse of the temple towards the end of the Gospel. Matthew, in his prologue, after describing the slaughter of the innocent children in Bethlehem by King Herod, which is a story, of course, it's big. It's not, first two chapters are not biographical. They're big theology painted in with a very wide brush about the meaning of Jesus. Well, King Herod was hoping to kill Jesus, and Matthew quotes Jeremiah, who's describing the lamentation. Jeremiah's describing the lamentation of the Jews who were taken out of Jerusalem, herded in Ramah, and from them carted into exile. That's what Jeremiah's talking about. A voice was heard in Ramah. Loud lamentation. Rachel, that's the wife of Jacob. The mother now. Rachel is weeping for her children, carted off, hundreds of them, to be deported into slavery. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. So anyone who's lived through a war understands all that. And that's the passage that Matthew finds useful, talking about the slaughter of the innocents of Bethlehem. Hebrews 8:8-12 quotes from this passage. The whole lot is quoted in Hebrews. It's a passage you know, and I'll conclude with this. It's from Jeremiah chapter 31. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with their ancestors on the day when I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, for they didn't continue in my covenant, that one. And so I had no concern for them, says the Lord. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Yahweh. I'll put my laws in their minds. I'll write them in their hearts. I'll be their God and they'll be my people. They won't be etched on stone anymore, out there somewhere to be obeyed. It'll all happen in here. They shall not teach one another or say to each other, know the Lord. For they'll all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I'll be merciful towards their iniquities and I'll remember their sins no more. So there's a whole scroll of Jeremiah. Beautiful stuff. I've left out all the punishment material. You read that for yourself. But it's a rich text, of course. And once you realise that it's being written during those tragic years, the fall and then the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile and the starvation and the plague, whatever happens when a city is starved and out of water and food. That's the period he's writing to. And he's trying to express his belief in God who will be faithful even though we're doing all this. So I'll finish with a piece of music. Oh God.